What do rock memoirs offer beyond the expected rags-to-riches redemption tale? Alan Light is here to talk about this week's shortlist on pop music and new memoirs that go beyond the cliches.
Even within this rock memoir genre, people have taken very different approaches to what that actually means.
How is it possible to be optimistic about today's extravagant economic inequality? David Leonhardt will join us to talk about his review of Angus Deaton's new book, The Great Escape: Health, Wealth, and the Origins of Inequality.
For most of human history, there were no increases in material living standards or in life expectancy, and the great escape that Deaton writes about is the escape from that very grim reality.
Julie Bosman will give us notes from the field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Alan Light is here to talk about pop music book reviews for the shortlist. The shortlist, of course, is a new-ish feature that we began in September that looks, it's brief reviews, looking at books according to genre or subject matter. And in this case, we have four books about pop music: Eminent Hipsters by Donald Fagen, Americana, The Kinks, The Riff, The Road, The Story by Ray Davies, Simple Dreams, a musical memoir by Linda Ronstadt, and Everybody's Brother by CeeLo with Big Gip. Gip? Help? Gip.
Gip.
Thank you. I am displaying my ignorance here. Sorry. And David Wild. Alan Light, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Glad I can be here.
So the first question I always have with these kind of books is, let's say you are not a CeeLo fan, not a Kinks fan, not a Ronstadt or a Steely Dan fan. Do you still want to read these books?
Well, I think if you're not remotely inclined to be interested, then it's probably, you know, that's not entirely fair, because the best of this genre, I mean, memoirs like Bob Dylan's book,
right,
like Patti Smith's book, I think really do
they rise
transcend.
Above, yeah.
Yeah. Certainly those are the exceptions, as with most memoirs or most writing at all, that it would appeal even if you're coming with no knowledge. I think of these books, certainly the Donald Fagen book is the one with the most ambition the most aspiration to be something other than just a fan memoir.
Beginning with the title Eminent Hipsters.
It's a different approach. And I think what we've seen over recent years is, even within this rock memoir genre, people have taken very different approaches to what that actually means. You had Sting's book that was about his childhood and ended with the police for one paragraph. You had Bob Dylan's book that really wasn't about the most biggest and most central moments of his career, but kind of these crossroad moments that he had. So for Donald Fagen, there's kind of two books that are mashed into one here. The first part is a collection of writings over the years that are reminiscences about growing up in New Jersey and kind of discovering these different hipsters and counterculture and subculture figures that inspired him to take this journey in the bohemian life.
Okay, that explains the kind of disconnect between the word hipster and Steely Dan.
Correct. Well, Steely Dan are certainly, you know, based on a lot of the sort of beatnik, old school coffee.
The original hipsters.
Yeah, the original hipsters. That was very much where they came from. This was a band that, you know, was using jazz chords before that was a thing that rock bands would think about doing. And so the first half of the book is this collection of reflections on growing up and these kind of mysterious heroes that invaded Donald Fagen's consciousness. And then the second half is a diary of a recent tour that he did, not with Steely Dan, but with this other project that he does with Michael McDonald and Boz Scaggs, doing old R&B songs and classic soul songs and material like that.
And what's Fagen like as a writer?
Well, as is evident from anybody who's listened to Steely Dan, this is somebody who's highly literate,
yes,
elusive, cynical, very writerly. When that works in this book, and I think in some of these essays in the first half of the book, they can be very witty and urbane and let you in on this feeling of growing up as a different kind of a kid in a very classic suburban town. And there's insightful ideas in there, not just familiar ones. I think that turns a little bit more sour in the second half of the book in this diary section, which we expect cynicism from Donald Fagen. The songs would tell you that. But I think writing about this recent tour turns kind of nasty and mean-spirited in places about the experience, about still touring, about the audience, sometimes in very personal ways that, I thought turned from cool and cynical into something more abrasive.
All right. Well, going to the opposite end of the temperamental spectrum, let's talk about Simple Dreams, Linda Ronstadt's new book, which came out earlier this fall, but she's back in the news with her induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And you're part of that decision-making process?
Not that we can elaborate too much, but yes, I'm part of the nominating committee for the
Hall
of Fame.
Okay. So I had to hear the timing. Had you read the memoir before that whole decision process?
I had read this memoir before, and obviously she got, when the book was coming out and she was doing the interviews that she did to promote it, was when there was a lot of news around Linda because of this announcement that she'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, which she does not mention in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that a lot of what people have been talking about the book is what's not in it.
Right.
The discussion of drugs that she was more open about in press interviews in the past, not mentioned so much in the book?
No, not so much in the book. And you know, again, nor this revelation about her health, not mentioned in the book. You know, she makes her intentions clear with this subtitle, A Musical Memoir, and says the focus here is not about the offstage stuff. It's about the music and the singing. But even there, the stuff that's beautiful in this book is talking about listening to music growing up. Mm-hmm. And she comes from a Mexican-American background. She grew up in Arizona, and she talks about this melange of pop music and Broadway music and jazz and Mexican music and all of these things that were informing her as a child. And that section is really, really lovely and tells you a lot about this range of projects that she pursued throughout her career. What's weird is that she seems really kind of embarrassed about the years that she spent as the biggest female pop star in the world in the 70s and blows through that in a couple of pages that's kind of dismissive about kind of how awful it is to play hockey rinks and big crowds. And she really doesn't want to talk about that. It's five or six pages about the phase of her career that, of course, is the thing that draws us all
to
her.
Does she talk about the sort of later stage of her career? Because I feel like by the time the 80s rolled around, anyone who said Linda Ronstadt, rock star, that, you know, did not seem who she was.
Well, yeah, she seems much more enthusiastic talking about doing Pirates of Penzance on Broadway, doing the series of Standards records with Nelson Riddle, doing the explorations of Mexican music that she did. Not as much about the trio record with Emmylou Harris and Dolly Parton as I would like, but you know, all of that stuff she seems much more interested in.
Really going back to her musical roots.
Than the extended run being a big, huge rock star. That feels like the thing that she most wants to avoid here.
Okay, CeeLo, Everybody's Brother, written with Big
Gip. Yes, Big Gip.
Thank you. And David Wild. What did you learn from this book?
Well, of this set of memoirs, CeeLo's book is probably the most conventional in that it's the most straight ahead telling of his story, you know, beginning to end. And this journey from street thug in Atlanta to judge on The Voice and Vegas performer and this kind of all-around entertainer.
And was he really a street thug? Because I feel like that's almost become
Yeah, we've heard that story before. I think that, he was not, a high roller gangster type, but he certainly talks about, robbing people on the street, threatening people and being, I think, a self-aware and you know, the sort of sensitive guy that he's created.
What
he talks a lot
him?
About where that came from, where his family relationships, you know, what it was about that he was acting out in those ways. And listen, he hasn't completely, you know, there was an arrest within the last few months. It's not like all trouble has left CeeLo behind. And coming from Atlanta, Big Gip, who is kind of a counter voice, Greek chorus, trying to keep him in check figure in this book. They mm-hmm. were part of a group called Goody Mob that was really a pioneering hip-hop group out of Atlanta. Atlanta at that time really wasn't the kind of musical center that it became, especially for black music. So there's this feeling that, you know, they were growing up outside of the spotlight with no particular chance to make it and found this seam and this style that got them over. And that beyond that, he wanted something more. He talks about growing up listening to pop records and rock and roll records and having interests outside of, you know, the music that usually goes into hip hop, and that's what's led him to be this more eccentric figure, more eccentric musical figure in his later life.
Okay, let's just touch briefly on Ray Davies' book, Americana, The Kinks, The Riff, The Road, The Story. This is the second book by Ray Davies.
Right. Yeah, Ray Davies, who's the leader of the Kinks, actually wrote one of the first in the rock memoir universe, a book called X-Ray. I'd have to go back in the 90s, I think.
94.
And this is, it's not so much a sequel. Part of, you know, it's sort of a sequel on a parallel track. It's really about his relationship to America and American music and American culture, which is a complicated one. First of all, because when the Kinks first toured in the States, they were banned and thrown out of the country for reasons that are still not entirely clear to him. And then after making his return, he was actually shot in a robbery attempt in New Orleans. And this book came out of his reflections mm-hmm. while recuperating from that. So it's a complicated relationship from this country that inspired his music and inspired so much of his writing, but also he's had these really difficult experiences with. So some of this book goes back as far as the X-Ray stuff, and some of it is more recent, but it's much more around this America concept than a straight memoir treatment.
Did you have a favorite, Alan, among these four books?
It's a mixed bag. Each of them have very different ambitions. I think the strong stuff in Linda Ronstadt's book, I think, is the best section of any of these books, but it's hard not to be frustrated by the stuff that she leaves out of that book. And I think with each of these, again, people are trying different ways to not just do the cliche sex, drugs, and rock and roll, battle it out in the garage and become a star story. And sometimes that works, and sometimes it works in places, which is, I think, what we see in these books.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Alan.
Thank you, Pam.
That was Alan Light talking about our shortlist this week on pop music.
Will I never be blue? My dreams come true. I'm blue by you.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is George Washington's Secret Six, The Spy Ring That Saved America, by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager. That's George Washington's Secret Six, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So we're going to talk about what's selling this holiday season.
Yes, this is that critical time of year for publishers and for bookstores when they get a huge chunk of their yearly sales in the weeks leading up to Christmas. And this was a compressed holiday season. Thanksgiving fell later than it had in a decade. So from the outset, publishers and booksellers were a little concerned that people would have fewer days to shop, and there was also kind of an absence of a really monster hit of a book this year. It was a bit of a scattered landscape in terms of what people were buying.
What was the big book last year?
Last year was really dominated by the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy.
Everyone got one in their stocking?
Yes, or wrapped in brown paper. And there was also the Hunger Games trilogy, of course, was still selling really well. So you had two huge series that really dominated sales into the holidays. And the year before that, it was the Steve Jobs biography, which was really a book that was driving people into bookstores. This year, when I called around and talked to 12 or 15 bookstores across the country, they said, you know, the big nonfiction title seemed to be the Doris Kearns Goodwin Bully Pulpit nonfiction, which was sort of a mix of biography and history of
the What to
the
Get
press.
Dad.
Yeah, it was the dad book of the year. And in fiction, it was, again, a really mixed bag. It was in a lot of the independent bookstores. Everyone said The Goldfinch was their big book. Dan Brown, Inferno, the Stephen King book, Dr. Sleep. On a little bit more of the commercial schmaltzy side, there was the Mitch Albom book, The First Phone Call from Heaven, which was just picking up speed in the last couple of weeks.
You know, that title, read a certain way, sounds kind of ominous for a holiday present.
Yes. And, or you could, you know, go with the Sarah Palin book. There were a lot of Fox News stars who have won spots on our nonfiction bestseller list, including Charles Krauthammer, who's sold an extraordinary number of books. Last I checked, more than 500,000 copies of his collection of columns, which is number one on our list, along with Bill O'Reilly, with Killing Jesus, an unusual Christmas present, but
not the obvious.
Seems to be selling pretty well. A couple bookstores told me that A Big Heart Open to God, which is the book version of the interview that Pope Francis gave a few months ago. And that seems to be picking up steam as, you know, kind of a small, gifty book for the devout Catholic in your life. One interesting thing this year is that a lot of booksellers were talking about what is happening with ebooks. Now, we've seen throughout 2013 that ebook sales have really been flattening. They're not growing the same rates that they were last year or the year before. So a lot of bookstores are hoping that that means that things are kind of settling in, that there's still going to be an appetite for print books.
People realize they still like to actually turn pages, flip through the index.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people, you know, who have already gotten their e-reader, you know, still want to buy print books for other people. It's not very easy to give someone the gift of an e-book. And I think that what we're seeing so far is that there's still a pretty healthy market for print books.
Well, thank you, Julie.
Thanks.
David Leonhardt joins us from Washington to talk about The Great Escape: Health, Wealth, and the Origins of Inequality by Angus Deaton. Leonhardt covers economics and politics for The Times. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So this book is called The Great Escape, and there's a reason for that title. What's behind that?
Yes, and it's a happy reason. It's describing the escape from centuries of poverty and early death. And I think all of us, everyone alive today was born in the 20th or 21st centuries, and for us, some version of progress is the norm. But for most of human history, it hasn't been. For most of human history, there were no increases in material living standards or in life expectancy, and the great escape that Deaton writes about is the escape from that very grim reality. And several hundred years ago, human beings figured out how to do things better. And we have lived through this incredible period, and our recent ancestors, this incredible period in which life expectancy has been growing. People live longer. They live healthier. They have resources that would have been unimaginable to people just a few generations ago.
They have flat-screen TVs.
They have flat screen TVs. They also can do things. I mean, my grandparents moved here from Europe, like a lot of people's, whether it's your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents. And when they came here, they left Europe behind, right? They couldn't go back. They couldn't easily call home. And now, of course, if you move here, you can go home. You can call home. You can go visit someplace just because you want to. Air travel has been democratized. And what's so provocative about Deaton's thesis and the way he argues it is, right now we think of things as being pretty bad, right? We think of we're living in this time of stagnation, and most of the book is a deeply optimistic argument.
Let's talk about Angus Deaton, because he is a big deal in economic circles, a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton. What is he most known for?
He is most known for really trying to take a broad view of economics and the human condition. And this book is in many ways his great work, which encapsulates a lot of his life's work. And trying to say, look, economics isn't simply the study of money. It's not simply the study of markets. It's really the study of human beings, of people. He, in recent weeks, since this book has come out, has also gotten some attention because he's quite skeptical about foreign aid, and that occupies some portion of this book. He basically argues that foreign aid doesn't do a whole lot of good, and that it's that societies are better left to their own devices rather than having rich countries give them a lot of money. There's obviously a huge amount of debate about that,
right.
But most of the attention he's gotten recently has been, much of it has been around that point.
That's the blurb from William Easterly on the back cover.
Exactly. People who don't like foreign aid like a lot of his argument. People who like foreign aid more have actually said, look, we agree with much of this book, but we disagree on foreign aid. In some ways, it is a little bit a matter of emphasis. Do you emphasize all the failings of aid, or do you emphasize its successes?
But so he talks about the great escape from this poverty and stasis, right? But isn't part of the result of that a great inequality in terms of standard of living?
It is, and he's really interesting about that, which is that inequality is the inevitable byproduct of progress, right? Imagine a society where we all make $100 a year. Or a society in which some of us make $150 and some of us make $100 and some of us make $50 a year, a horrifically poor society. To get progress, you're almost certainly going to get inequality. Not everybody is going to proceed at the same rate. So some part of inequality we should feel perfectly good about. And sometimes, in fact, inequality allows everyone to catch up, right? There are things that rich people get first. I mentioned air travel a few minutes ago. And then the middle class and even the poor get. Look at things like indoor heating or air conditioning in the South and in the summer. That kind of inequality is good because it leads to progress. But we're now at this moment, and Deaton acknowledges this, in which the levels of inequality that we see in the rich world and in parts of the middle-class world or the developing world, like China, really are alarming. I mean, there is this other book that's come out recently called Why Nations Fail, which argues that one of the common denominators of fallen great powers is inequality. And so while there's a good aspect of inequality, it seems like we maybe have blown past the good part of it and are into the dangerous part now.
But overall, Deaton takes a kind of optimistic look at sort of the state of human progress.
Yes, deeply optimistic. I mean, I think he reminds people that even if you live in the West, even if you live in the United States and you think, yeah, but all the progress is in the past or all the progress is in China, you're making a mistake. Some of the greatest progress we've made against cancer and heart disease has been very recent. It's been in recent decades. He doesn't really write about this, but one thing the book made me think about is, think of the massive decline in discrimination in our society, whether it's religious discrimination over the last 50 or 60 years against Catholics and Jews, whether it's against sexism against women, whether it's racism, whether it's more recently discrimination against gays and lesbians. I am not suggesting that we live in a society without discrimination, but I don't see any argument that we clearly live in a society with less discrimination. And so life really has improved. There are some big challenges. I mentioned inequality. There's a whole question of why economic growth has slowed down in so much of the world. There's climate change, which may be the scariest thing of all. And I left the book thinking that what has caused so much progress in recent years is really the ideas at the heart of the Enlightenment. It's the idea that evidence and facts matter, and that if you apply them, the world can become a better place. And I think the question for us today becomes, are we actually applying evidence and facts to our most difficult problems, and are we really trying to solve them?
Well, it sounds like a fascinating book. David Leonhardt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Pamela.
That was David Leonhardt, an economics writer at The Times, former Washington bureau chief, talking about Angus Deaton's new book, The Great Escape, Health, Wealth, and the Origins of Inequality. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So what have we got this week?
We're going to be looking at the hardcover bestsellers. And what's new on the list this week is, are you ready?
Not much.
Innocence by Dean Koontz. Period, the end. That's new on the hardcover fiction list at number 9. And literally, it is the only new title on the hardcover lists at all this week.
What are we going to talk about?
We could talk about Innocence by Dean Koontz. It is a standalone novel. It's not one of his Odd Thomas series that he has been consistently hitting the list with lately. This is kind of a updated suspense version of Beauty and the Beast. It's about a deformed guy living underground in total seclusion, and the beautiful girl who's on the run who meets him, and what their connection is.
You know, that kind of makes sense because Dean Koontz is what passed for YA literature when I was in that demographic in the 80s. So
that's funny. For me, it was Stephen King, but same idea.
Oh, and yes.
In my column this week, I write about a guy who has published both Stephen King and Dean Koontz. He's had a decades-long relationship with Dean Koontz. He buys the limited edition rights to his books and publishes them in sets of, you know, a numbered run of maybe 150 books, or a lettered run of just 26 books, and sells them for, designs them by hand. He prints them on handmade paper and binds them in leather with kind of high concept cover ideas that take elements out of the story and incorporate them into the cover design. For Stephen King, he used real Winchester bullets for his book The Regulators, and he's designed limited edition copies of Dean Koontz's Innocence and that are selling for as much as $1,000.
Wow. Dean Koontz Deluxe for your shopping lists.
Yeah, it's funny. He acknowledges outright that these are kind of just pop culture books, that they're truly commercial fiction, but he's trying to turn them from that into real, like, fine art, and he finds collectors who want to buy that.
Greg, do we see this kind of stasis on the bestseller list every holiday season, where people are kind of turning to the books that have worked?
We do. It's again, it's not that they're not buying books anymore. It's that as they're starting to buy books for presents or
Holiday reading.
They're turning to the tried and true, the things that have been on the list for a long time. And so you've got John Grisham topping the list once again, and he's been on the list for almost a couple of months now. You've got Mitch Albom and Tom Clancy, and all the people who've really been on the list for a long time are still on there.
All right, so we won't miss you next week when you won't be in to talk about bestsellers, but we'll hopefully have some new books to talk about in January.
You won't miss me?
Of course we'll miss you.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.